Welcome to Already Perfect, the Seattle Soto Zen podcast. And I needed a push to get me to see wherever I
I'm going to start off by saying happy Easter and happy Passover to all of you. You know, these two holidays represent not only the resurrection and fleeing of Egypt, but the origin of a new life for those peoples, for all peoples, and for us. It also represents returning to our original nature or original self, and or bodhicitta. And that's a lot of what these 12 steps are about, the 12 steps in general, and these 12 anti-racism steps in particular. So I'm going to give a quick little history of the 12 steps. They were originally came down to us through Alcoholics Anonymous. However, Alcoholics Anonymous derived them from six steps that was used by an organization called the Oxford Group, a very Christian group. And Bill Wilson, one of the primary two founders of AA, said, it should be noted that many to the Oxford Group and practices were discarded because they were incompatible with what he and Dr. Bob wanted to do with AA. And I mention this because those 12 steps have revised themselves over the years, and they've changed and mutated. And that's what Tim and I have done with those 12 steps. I've been in recovery with AA in particular for 30 years now, and I've continued to work these steps. But now, and they are modified by many, many groups. The steps were followed the creation of AA by several years after AA had actually started. And they were originally published in what's referred to as the Big Book in 1938, a program of recovery. So these 12 steps continue to be adopted by numerous organizations dealing with all forms of addictive behavior. So I present these, and Tim presents these to you for your interest, for your participation, hopefully, and for your growth and resurrection and of developing a closer contact with one's original nature. So now I'll turn it over to Tim, and he can tell you why we did create 12 anti-racism steps.
Thanks, Roger. Roger and I actually knew each other before we were in recovery. We've known each other for a very long time. I have 22 years in recovery for alcoholism and drug addiction. And it was actually that work, doing the steps, that brought me to the Zen Center in the first place. They had at the time just started a meeting that has continued on Monday nights called Meditation in Recovery for people who are interested in Buddhism and who are doing specifically 12-step work. So Roger and I know each other from that practice, as well as previous less disciplined practices outside of recovery. So we've known each other for a long time. And at San Francisco Zen Center, which is a institution which is primarily run by white people, and this has been a big problem. And there has been a vocalization from many people, people of color, as well as whites, that makes it difficult for people of color to come if they don't see people in leadership positions. And there have been discussions around this, a lot of frustration from people of color. and that things were not going quickly, changing quickly enough. And many of us have been open to that frustration and shared it, in fact. And as a result of the discussion, we have a diversity section, which has now been elevated to a higher management level, staff level. Diversity, inclusivity, equality, and access, DEIDIEA. And as a part of the training that group has offered, we've been doing diversity training. And so Roger and I were in a meeting, one of these diversity training meetings, where there was, it was all on Zoom. It's probably a year ago, maybe. One of the speakers on the, in the Zoom training was, Professor Ibram X. Kendi, who's, well known now. He wrote a book called, How to Be an Anti-Racist. It's been very influential. He's written a bunch of other stuff. But on this section, he said, he likened racism, to alcoholism. And for Roger and I both, a light went off. You know, what I heard Professor Kendi say was that, you know, racism is something, you know, it's bad for you. You know, it's actually killing you in many ways, but you continue doing it. And that really struck me as applicable as far as my own experience with addiction was concerned and my own experience with racism. I see it very deeply as something which is tearing us apart and has deeply and profoundly affected my practice. What the steps do for Roger and I, the reason why the light went off is the steps in our experience with AA and in NA, which I also have done the steps there, and in Al-Anon, which is for family and friends of people who are addicts and alcoholics, in ACA, which is adult children of alcoholics, which is, these are all slightly different ways of working these steps. What you learn is that the steps identify behavior which is harmful to you and to others. And so this was very important in directing us towards adapting these steps towards racism, to identify racist behavior and harmful racist actions, and to begin to take responsibility for those actions and behavior as we shift our relationship with the world and how it is that we act in the world. So it's a process of identifying behavior and then making amends. Sometimes this is seen as making apologies, if that's appropriate. But it's mostly about amending your, the person who's doing the steps, amending your behavior, changing your behavior. It's about seeing the suffering of ourselves and how it is that we affect the rest of the world. And sorry if this is like a radio show, but over to you, Roger, for the next section.
So the next thing is, how did we do this? And as Tim said, when Ibram X. Kendi in his TED talk mentioned that racism is addictive, just a light went off for me. And similarly, Tim and I were talking later and the same thing happened for him. And we got the idea of, let's apply the principles of recovery to this. Let's work on creating 12 steps of anti-racism. And I do want to acknowledge that in some of our research and looking around, there is a group called Racist Anonymous that was actually started here in the Bay Area of California. But we looked at what they were doing and how they were doing it and the way their steps were worded. And what we wanted to do was write these steps from a Buddhist perspective. And as you may well know, in AA, they're somewhat very, given their origins of the Oxford group and on, but very Christian oriented. And the Racist Anonymous steps were somewhat similar. So Tim and I would meet once a week, and we've been doing this for over a year now. And we worked on writing these steps, and we discussed them and how we wanted to word them and how it would fit with our Buddhist practice. And we wanted them to encompass the precepts and the Bodhisattva vows. So we spent several months adapting these, writing and rewriting them on that weekly basis and discussing them. Steve, I'm wondering if you could post the 12 anti-racism steps in the chat or screen share them. That would be great. Thank you. So that's basically how we did it. We discussed it with some other people. We haven't kept it solely to ourselves, but mainly it was the focus so that we could develop these and then begin to spread and share them. So hopefully you will sense and feel that Buddhist perspective in these, and you will be able to relate them to the precepts and to relate them to the Bodhisattva vows. So again, I'll pass it back to Tim, and he can tell you how it's going. And there's the anti-racist 12 steps.
So as you can see, the first step right here is famous, you know, first of all, you have to admit it. You have to admit it right there. That you're an alcoholic, we're familiar with that. You have to be able to admit that you're an alcoholic or a drug addict or a codependent or an adult child of alcoholics. And that's what that first step is, because the rest of them aren't going to work unless you do that one as thoroughly as possible. And then this the process of this, the second and third step are about opening up that admission and investigating that truth that for me, the way it is that I did it was that, you know, I am conditioned in this culture, even though I've been anti-racist all of my life and was very active for 20 years, starting when I was 16 as a political anti-racist. I have to be able to see the power of my conditioning. These are our karmic responsibilities. And that was important for me to do in that first step, and then to deepen that investigation in steps two and step three. And step four is making a list, an inventory, looking at what it is has happened in my life. And I begin the process of identifying specific events and thought patterns and behaviors that I know about because they're happening right here in this place that is my body and in my mind, to look and see how it is that racism has manifested it even inside of me. And Roger and I both did this. And then in step five, we join together and we talk about it. You speak to another person, another human being. And this is the critical part of being an alcoholic in 12-step recovery, is that it's called mutual aid, to where it is that you're working with another human being. You're not off sitting on your own. Maybe you'll do it, maybe you won't. This is being accountable to another human being right there. So admitted to myself and another human being the full content of my racist thoughts and actions. And this was very difficult. This is very painful to do. But because Roger and I have known each other for a long time, and because we trust each other, and we've practiced, we have a Zen practice, we've been practicing, I was able to be vulnerable with Roger, and I felt as though Roger was able to be vulnerable to me. Roger worked much of his life in the food service industry. I've worked most of my life supporting myself in the construction industry, and there's plenty of behaviors that even with the greatest intention will rub off on you and become internalized and in this context are to be looked at and to be brought forward with another human being. So it's in this process that we begin to see how deeply and profoundly conditioned it is that we are. And even though I had done a lot of work around racism and I considered myself very much to be an anti-racist, it was very disappointing to see really how deeply it is this conditioning has gone. But it's through that process of seeing how deeply the conditioning goes that I can begin the process of taking responsibility for it and making amends, changing my behavior. And so what this is leads to is the sixth and the seventh step are humility steps. So in AA, you really start from a place of total failure. In our Zen practice, there's something similar that happens that's very important to me. We vow to save all beings, and this is not really possible. But we continue to make that vow every day. And it's the intention that is important, not the overwhelming reality that I'm probably never going to be able to save all beings. The intention, by making that vow over and over again, becomes very pure in its own way, even though there's an imperfection in how it is that I'm doing it. So these are humility steps right here. In step eight, we make a list of people it is that we've harmed. So once again, we're being very specific and about what it is that happened and identifying these parts of us that need to be brought to the fore and looking very deeply at them, seeing sometimes what's behind them. Fear, a lot of the time, is what it is behind them. And then we go into beginning the process of making amends in steps 9 and 10 and 11 and 12 are about really coming to terms with this new way of living, with the new knowledge that we have of ourselves and the intention to continue the process of being accountable to another human being. Roger and I have been working on this talk for several weeks when we meet on Saturdays. And so that yesterday, our talk was finished. It was ready to go. And so yesterday we returned to our work, which is still on step 9 right now. And, you know, I had to admit to Roger that I hadn't really been doing my step 8 work that well. And so, you know, he held me to account and said, well, what are you going to do this week? And so it's very specific in how it is that we proceed. And why don't you go ahead there, Roger?
I want to remind you, Tim, that it is now this week as of today.
I know. Thank you, Roger.
So how is it going for me is I've been focusing on step 9, the making of amends. And it reads, as we wrote it, with courage, we made direct or indirect amends to all peoples we had harmed, except when to do so would create more harm. So I focused on Native Americans. And as I sit here now, I'm speaking to you from Bolinas, a very small village in West Marin, just across the bridge from San Francisco. And I'm sitting on the land of the Coast Miwoks, particularly the Glen clan. And so realizing that, you know, that I'm on their land, which they have not been compensated for, that it was taken away from them. And I felt that this was a great place for me to focus my amends, my first amends. And interestingly, as I've been doing that, I've been studying and I've been reading and I've been investigating and talking to people. You know, I realized how deep this went in me, and I'm old enough that, you know, as a young child, I listened to radio programs. You know, there was a program, Red Rider, and Red Rider had a sidekick called Little Beaver. Little Beaver was an Indian, and it was just, Little Beaver was the archetype, stereotype Indian, and I'm realizing, you know, I'd forgotten about this entirely, how deep a lot of these cultural ideas and concepts and stereotypes are embedded in me. And I find it with not just with Native Americans, but I find it with other racial groups also. And so it goes very, very deep. And so it's a long and lengthy process to learn about these. So as I've learned about the coastal Miwoks and actually other Indian Native American tribes, I don't know if you know of Louise Erdick, but she's a great writer from Minnesota, and she has a new book called The Sentence. And in that book, she is a Native American herself. She addresses a lot of issues. And one of the things she mentions in that, she mentions many other books in this book of fiction, but one of them is Everything You Know About Indians Is Wrong. And this is by Paul Chat Smith, who is a Native American. And he is a curator for the American Indian Museum as a part of the Smithsonian. And he has an incredible sense of humor, but he's very much to the point. And he points out all this, how so many of us become wannabe Indians. And I went through that in the 60s in my hippie time. You know, I wanted to be an Indian. I particularly loved the Hopi. And so I tried to adopt various what I thought were their cultural aspects. But I'm slowly learning about this. And I found some very interesting things, ancestral homes, reciprocity programs. And another one is that this is coming from the Miwoks, is that, you know, four ways to help. And it's donate money. And I thought, well, I can't donate money. I don't have very much money. And then I realized, you know, I love ice cream. If I just bought one less pint of ice cream a month, that's roughly $7. I could donate that on a monthly basis. And then the next thing is donate time. And so I'm planning to donate my time. There is actually a Miwok village, or a replica of a Miwok village not far from here up in Point Reyes. And then it says promote reciprocity. And that means help contact businesses that operate on the land, in the homelands, and talk to them about this, and then learn and share. So those are the approaches that I'm making to this amend process. And where it goes from here is, you know, I think it's very important that we talk to groups like you to create, Tim and I have talked about perhaps create down the road, creating workshops and meetings and step groups. And it needs to be based on action. The steps are about action and being in touch, as I said before, with our original self or our bodhicitta. And it gives us an opportunity to cultivate what I like to call our garden of karma, because we have this huge garden of karma, and maybe the weeds need to be composted and the new seeds need to be watered. But these are all ways in which we can go about this within our Zen practice. So hopefully this will pick up momentum as it goes, and some of you or all of you will desire to participate in whatever way works for you. Maybe just reading those steps and putting them away, or maybe forming groups and continuing from there. So I'll give it to Tim for a wrap up.
So we are in our Zen practice, we are all bodhisattvas in training. And we are asked to look at our own suffering in this body, right here, right now, where it is that we are. And so for me, that also led me to looking at the Native Americans right here in San Francisco, where I live. And as Roger said, the steps are based in action, but also for Native peoples, as you can see, you might not have noticed, but I've just put a land acknowledgement next to my name for the local Native Americans, the Ramaytush Ohlone. And Native Americans are happy to have that land acknowledgement done. There's not full agreement with Native Americans about whether or not people should do it or whether or not it's a token thing to do, to just put the name up. What almost all of them ask is to become involved somehow, as Roger said, in action somehow. And that's different everywhere it is that you go. So Roger spoke about some of the things that he's doing. The local Ramatush in my area have been subject to what's called institutional erasure. So that when I researched the local Native Americans in the 1980s, I found out that, oh, they were all extinct. There weren't any. But actually, that's not true. They were suppressed and murdered, many of them, but they were still there. Sometimes in some situations, it's actually dangerous to be known as a local Native American. And now there's the beginning of organizations that I can connect with, but there still are many consequences as a result of institutional erasure. And so you have to kind of figure out, how are you going to practice with this, with yourself in your place, where it is that you are in your time. And this is what it is that I feel my Bodhisattva training asks me to do, the appropriate response for the right place and the right time. I'm learning to cultivate wisdom around that. Our 12-step work, there's a motto, there's lots of mottos. They love mottos in AA. But one of them is, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. And what this is based in is that when you come to this work at a place of failure and overwhelm, of uncovering the depth of racism and racist conditioning in us, it seems like almost impossible work to do. But if you just begin, take that first step, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through to see what it is that is actually happening. Because we don't know what it is that is going to happen if we do the work. This is our don't know mind that we practice in our Zen practice. Don't know mind doesn't mean be passive and don't do anything. Don't know mind is cultivated with an open heart, but by still doing the work, by sitting Zazen, by reading the sutras, by engaging in Sangha. So it's not to be passive, but to be active. We want, both Roger and I individually, but also as Zen practitioners, we all want a world where there is no racism anymore. How it is that we're going to get there, we don't know. All it is is that throughout this process of looking very closely inside of us, we keep an eye on that intention right there to end racism, because that's easy for us to do, because we're trying as bodhisattvas in training to end suffering for all beings. It's not just about me. It's not just about me taking care of mine. I live in a racist culture which has conditioned me pick up some of the characteristics in a harmful way to others. Our Zen practice begins with I came to San Francisco Zen Center because I was an alcoholic, and I didn't want to really practice the steps in a Christian way, so I came to a Buddhist institution. And that's how it is for almost everyone I know who comes to Zen. They come to Zen because they are suffering, and they're aware of their suffering, and they're attracted to this set of ideas which addresses the suffering of the individual. But our 12-step work begins in AA with I, and it ends with we. It's a we program, we're saying all the time. And that is also true of our Zen practice. We come to the practice because of our own personal suffering. And by investigating that personal suffering, we begin to open our heart and soften our edges around our own suffering and begin to see how that suffering is in others as well. This is the famous story of Kisa Gotami, who lost her child. We think of that pain, that suffering, as the greatest of all, a mother who loses a child. But it's only through seeing how that suffering was shared by everyone else that she was able to enter the Sangha and eventually, so we're told, become enlightened. So we see through our Zen training in Zazen, in our study of the sutras, and in our being in community with others, in this case, me being in community somehow with Native Americans, as well as with the fact that San Francisco Zen Center is run by white people, being in community with Roger and talking about this. This is all the action of our taking our vows in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the three treasures. We see through this training that we're actually connected throughout space and time. This is such one of the most amazing things. So we're extending our compassion beyond ourselves and our own suffering, beyond along with the people who are immediately around us, but also throughout space and time. And so this, in my experience, gives me energy to accept and investigate the overwhelm of the deep and profound conditioning that I have. So now what I'm able to do is I'm able to actually see when it is that racist or prejudiced thoughts begin to appear inside of me. And this for me is the result of doing these steps for a very short period of time. And then I get to talk about it with Roger when it is that when it comes up at the end of the week. And this is very important, breaking this boundary of isolation and individuality, which we are also conditioned with in our culture, is to be able to share that with Roger. And it's that working with a trusted person that is really essential right here and is truly the great action of living in Sangha. And where it's going to go, we're not sure. As Roger mentioned, you know, people have made inquiries. We might do workshops if it looks like it will be helpful with people. But I'm going to go ahead and end it right there. And thank you so much for inviting us, Eno and Allison. And we would love to have time for questions if that's possible.
I just want to add that each morning at San Francisco Zen Center, we recite the repentances. And it goes, all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. And this is a part of fully avowing that twisted karma that runs deep within us. So we then say, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, and I take refuge. And Tim and I are taking refuge with all of you and encourage your support, your questions, and your participation in any way you might like to. And if you have any ideas or suggestions, please let us know. And I also want to thank Allison and thank Steve. I really appreciate it. And it's so special to see Lance, who was just recently at City Center. Good to see you, buddy. Thanks.
I think we have time for a few questions. So go ahead and raise your little yellow hand if you have a question. Daniel, go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for that talk. It was really insightful. And certainly the framework is not a framework I considered. The two things overlapping. So that was a really wonderful way of looking at that. You mentioned that you're working at the San Francisco Zen Center on addressing the sort of whiteness of leadership and community. And I'm curious if you could expand upon that and talk to us about how you're approaching that, because I think it's a very difficult thing and an important thing. So I'm curious how you're approaching that.
Roger, you want to go first or shall I?
Well, I'll just say one thing that has been done there is now there is a formal staff position of the director of DEIA. And that person is very competent, very capable, and very skilled. And so it now has a focal point from which, you know, things can disperse and be brought into action. We continue to have monthly diversity workshops on Saturday mornings at Zen Center. So it's a real effort to not just make it a policy, but to make it a program of action.
I just want to add that, practitioners of color have articulated the problems of tokenism. And so, it's a difficult situation to elevate people it's difficult without considering racism to elevate people to positions higher up in the institution. This is in many ways an archaic institution with all the problems of institutions. And so to add to it, elevating people to positions of power in a way to address racism and the visible presence of people of color, it's all very difficult, but it is what it is that has to be done, and discussions need to be had, and we are having those, as Roger said. It's very important to have as broad a conversation institutionally as is possible. So that's what it is that we've been trying to do.
Thank you very much.
Diane, go ahead.
Me a while to unmute. I'm deeply touched by what you're doing, and for me, there's your connection of working with alcoholism and drugs, and the fact that the two of you have this relationship where you can be who you are, and you both have skills to allow that. I am concerned just recently with a Lotus Insight group that I participate in at Seattle. And our teacher, Rena Wiseman, lives in Domodina, so she's not directly with us. We were reading a book, and I was being slammed down time after time because I did not know what the words were. You've got a slur. Well, to me, 83 years old, a slur is someone who's kind of tipsy and can't talk right, or you can't pronounce your words right. And no one ever took the courtesy to say this is what a slur is. And so I'm cut off on that. I'm telling a story of when I'm 8 years old in the South, and I'm going to use the word. They wanted to know how we got changed maybe about things. So I'm a little kid, white kid in the South. There's the public bathrooms. There's white, and then there's colored. I said the word colored, and my God, they all jumped on me. And this little eight-year-old me that was there was very, very hurt. And I'm still working with the piss about it. And so what I want to bring in is leadership skilled someplace. Nobody has ever sent me a list of what the new words are. I'm beginning to understand white men who want to call me a young lady when I'm in my 80s. Nobody's told them, I'm sure, that this changed. Women want to be women. And so I just want to bring this out because it's so, I think we didn't have a leader. It was just us doing it. And I think that's a big issue. And I just would like to, I'm hoping to see us do some stuff with this, but I think you really, really need to be concerned about hurting people who don't understand. Am I making any sense with what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Laura, yeah. Yeah. All of this has to be a part of our continued work. This isn't the only work that Roger and I are doing. As Roger mentioned, there's the DEIA work that is done. We talk about it with other people as well. So it's a multi-pronged approach, and it's important to find places that are safe, that you trust, where you're with people who you trust. I want to encourage you, Diane, to continue looking for places where it is that you feel as though you can bring these concerns forward. Your pain that I see and is just simply indicative of how deep this conditioning goes. You're not alone in the pain and the frustration and the sense of separation that you're experiencing. These are have been articulated by many other people. What are the new words? Why am I being separated out as being someone who's doing it wrong? So this is all a part of the conversation, and finding safe places is critical.
I don't know if it was at the bottom of that, of the 12 anti-racism steps, but usually we put on the bottom there that these steps were created by two old privileged white men. And, you know, I appreciate what you're saying, Diane, that I'm continually misusing the appropriate pronouns. And a lot of it is just, I'm 79 years old, and, you know, it's just indoctrinated. But slowly I'm learning, and thankfully I live at San Francisco Zen Center with a lot of young people, and I don't mind being corrected, but I do need that. It's a practice, and it's continually changing and evolving too. So it's not easy to keep up with all of it, but it's educational to try, and it's important to try and to do that. So yes, it can be difficult.
And before you all get injured in any way, I just want to let you know that Roger checked in with me beforehand if it was okay for him to call me an old man. I told him that it was.
Kanchan, you're next, please.
Hello. Thank you so much. I was just wondering if you could say something briefly about karma and generational trauma. I gave a Dharma talk, it was probably 2 years ago, where I talked about generational trauma, and I used the example of a family friend who inherited his mother's horrible, vicious parrot. And I said, you know, it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility. And if you're stuck with your mom's parrot, you know, if you're mean to it or neglect it, it's just going to get worse. Although you don't have to love it or be grateful for it. But and I think obviously racism and addiction are examples of generational trauma and family karma.
You know, I would say it's not only generational karma, it's ancestral karma. And we have a responsibility for that, both generational and ancestral. And definitely it is a part of our garden of karma, which makes us definitely responsible for acknowledging it, working with it, dealing with it, transmuting it into something, I hesitate to use the word, but more positive. It can be very educational and very helpful, but it can also be painful and even traumatic dealing with it. So it's something we need to immerse ourselves in, but proceed cautiously.
Very, very important. So in the beginning of this work is, I didn't own slaves. I didn't practice genocide around Native Americans. That's in the beginning of this work. As you begin to go through this process and see how deep and how painful it is, I can attach actual things that I've done in my life to certain internal experiences, and then I'm left with something which is deeper. This, to me, is generational trauma. It's generational karma. many of us don't believe in karma in the traditional reincarnation way, that you were another human being in another life. But certainly my father's alcoholism and addiction and untreated mental health issues were passed on to me somehow in ways beyond just simply being around him. And this is true also for racism and the genocide around Native Americans. There is a deep place inside of me that is deeply injured because I'm living on land, which is unceded land where genocide took place. This is the spiritual awareness that we have of transmission and lineage. And this is sometimes more subtle part of our practice, but a very deep and powerful part of our practice, is learning about transmission from person to person and generation to generation. And uncovering the evidence of that means uncovering the deep and profound and sometimes overwhelming pain that exists and that I experience inside.
Jeff, why don't you have the last question? You have to unmute, though.
I want to thank Tim very much and Roger for all this wonderful talk. I'm very much like Tim. I consider myself never having engaged in racism. So it was a big puzzle for me, and I think you just answered it. What you know, we are responsible for, what's transmitted from our father. My father was certainly responsible for a lot of bad racist action, even though he probably didn't consider himself a racist. He helped finance Biafran massacres and as one of the heads of Standard Oil. And, you know, but I've never considered myself, and so as being racist. I've lived with Muslims. I've lived, you know, I remember having a black maid when I was four or five who took care of me. And she was so black, I was wondering if it would rub off on me. I didn't know that color. You know, I wasn't afraid of it, but, I think about all the people in my life, I would not have thought of anyone I'd harmed as, you know, as a racist. You know, there's so many things that come to mind that I've done that are beneficial. So I guess just taking responsibility for what's gone on in the past and what's shaped us and what's, you know, the privilege we have from taking it away from others. And, so thank you very much. And I think you did answer my question. And thanks for painting my house, Tim.
It's nice to look inside your house again, the beautiful house that Jeff has. He did all that joinery work you see behind him right there.
All right. Incredible thanks to Tim and Roger. Deep gratitude for your teaching, your presence, and for sharing the work that you're doing. And I needed a push to get me to see. Wherever I am, I'm already free.
Thank you for listening. Please find us at seattlesotozen.org. Our theme music is by Stuart Davis. Gosho!